Surfers know as much as anyone about the healing power of the ocean, and a group of them has organized an effort to bring more of that healing power to those who need it most. Access Surf is a local nonprofit that works to provide people with disabilities with access to the beach and the ocean. Kara Short is its executive director, and she's here in our studio with Bill Martin, North Shore business owner, to talk about their effort to create greater access on Oahu's North Shore. Kara, Bill, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Kara, what's the current state of disability access on Hawaii's beaches?
Well, overall, there's definitely some improvements that we need to make for sure. But I do hear from some visitors that we have better access than some places, but we feel like locally we could do a whole lot more. And that's exactly what we're doing with Access Surf. We provide programs, but we also feel part of our role in the community is to be advocates. And that's exactly what we're trying to do right now.
Bill, you've been in a chair for the last 8 years, and you're a surfer. You're a man who loves the ocean. What kind of issues do you run into trying to get to the water?
Well, mainly it's just the access. The sidewalks often end quite far away from the shore. Mm-hmm. And in Hawaii, because of the big surf, the sand is quite soft. So, I have where the wheelchair stops, I have quite a big distance to cover mm-hmm. to get into the water. So that's the case at all the beaches.
And you have what kind of vehicle do you have?
You mean as far as
how do you get around?
Oh, I have a van that's outfitted with hand controls, and it's like a little ramp. It's really convenient. I just mm-hmm. can get right in and out because I'm quite busy. I've got two kids. I got to take them to school and projects and
sure.
work. And
but when you go to the beach, what do you run into in your van?
Well, the van is, the parking and all that's no problem. And I can actually get I'm quite independent. I guess they call it high functioning or mm-hmm. something. I don't even know the terms. I just
that's good
go
enough.
With it.
Yeah.
So, but I can get all my gear out and down and I can get in and out of the water, but it's a challenge.
From the sidewalk to the water, it sounds like where the problem is.
Yeah.
So what would you like to see done there?
I'd just like to see, Hawaii in particular, we have a lot of surfers and also even swimmers who are disabled. And the more access we can create, the better. And so what we've found is there's like these temporary sort of mats that we can use and install.
I was wondering, if you could just roll out a rubber mat or something.
Yeah. And there's something like that. There's some things that are a little more almost permanent, but they're not permanent. You know, it's not a sidewalk that goes down to the water. Mm-hmm. So it's a good tool.
Have you seen those, Kara?
Yeah, actually, we've worked with Bill and the crew up north, and we've also worked with city and county years ago to put some mats in Ala Moana and Kaimana. At our programs, we use very temporary mats that we'll roll out. Mm-hmm. They're like made of like a woven nylon almost. But mm-hmm. the mats that they just installed up north, in which we're hoping to do some in Waikiki, it's a permanent temporary mat type thing. Like, so it will be in place. So, low theft and all that stuff. And it will hopefully, will weather quite well. The new products that they're using now, there's a company we're working with called Access. And they their new product is very good. We were really impressed with it so far. So, yeah, it's a great way to, it's a great in-between. I think some people have proposed sidewalks and so on and so forth. But I think there's some issues with that, definitely with the shifting sands and all that sort of thing, where these mats are the perfect solution we found so far.
What do they cost? Are they costly?
Yeah, they are. I mean, for about 50 feet, it's about $5,000. Or how much was that last mat that you just put in, Bill?
Yeah, it was a bit more than that because you have mm-hmm. to have it shipped over, and I think it comes out probably about $400 a piece. And it's a little 6x4 pieces that we use.
And then you just stick them together for the length you
need. Yep, you can stake them down. And then in the case for the North Shore, if we're quite good at surf forecast these days. So if a giant swell's coming, we can have them remove quite quickly. And mm-hmm. and then at Waimea Bay, for example, in the summertime, there's no big swells. You could go all the way down to the water, and that is my goal, to do that.
What does it do for you to get into the water, Bill?
Oh, it's night and day. You know, it's you come up to the beach, you get down, you wheel right down to the waterside, and just save me a lot of effort.
But I mean, what's the experience like of being in the water for you?
Oh.
Therapeutic?
Oh, totally. And it's like that way anyway. Surfers all know that, whether you're in a wheelchair or not. But for me, just all of a sudden I'm free again. You know, once I get in the water, I feel like a fish. But when I'm on the ground or in the, you know, I'm definitely dragging because of my disability.
That's a huge change of consciousness.
Yes.
And I would think a very healthy one for you.
Very.
So that's kind of the motivator behind all this, isn't it, Kara?
Absolutely. And like Bill said, for the local disabled community, but as well as our visitors, and, you know, we were talking about this earlier, those mats can provide easier access for people who are not in chairs. Maybe they have a walker or a cane or even a stroller, that sort of thing. So it's multi-use, you know, but it does hit a demographic that currently has no access. So that's a really big part, not only to get to the water, but just to get onto the sand, just to be part of Hawaii. That's such a huge resource that we have such limited access to right now.
How did you become aware of this issue?
Well, I personally became aware of this issue working with Access Surf. I've been with Access Surf for many years as a volunteer and since 2014 as their director. And, of course, this has been a very prevalent thing now in my life, not only from the programs, but a lot of my friends that I surf with are in chairs. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of my friends have to drag themselves across the beach or they have to concoct, you know, some sort of chair with wheels, or we ask people that are standing by to help us carry.
They just physically carry them out there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
You surf with other folks with disabilities, Bill?
Oh, yeah.
And obviously you talk to them about these issues?
Yes.
Are these the kind of things that you hear, the things that we've been talking about?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Particularly that, you know, the thing I find most powerful in what you're telling me is that sense of freedom you get once you get in the water.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, a lot of us are surfed before our accident or whatever reason. So, that it's really important for us to do that. A lot of people say to me, oh, wow, I can't believe you're doing this. But I always remind them that, hey, you would do the same thing. If you're a surfer, that's all you're thinking about is how can I get back?
Frequently when you ask people about something that's that much a part of their life, the answer comes back, well, what else would I do?
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds as if it's kind of what it was like for you. Kara, it doesn't sound as if the solutions are that expensive compared to the solutions in other areas.
You know what? You're right. It's absolutely true. I guess, you know, I run a small nonprofit, so those price tags sound big to me, but you're right. In the grand scheme of things, it's really not.
So what does it take? Awareness?
It takes awareness and it takes talking to the right people. So currently I am talking with some people in Sitting County to talk about Waikiki and having some mats there. And I've gotten a really good response. The issue always does come down to the who's going to pay for it. But I have had some very positive meetings, so I'm feeling very hopeful. Bill was really creative in what he did was he gathered the local business communities on the North Shore, and they got together and they actually sponsored it themselves. So I thought that was pretty impressive. So that might be a road I will go down if we can't find the funding in the city budget.
Well, Kara and Bill, we're going to want to keep in touch with you as this progresses to see how it's all doing. But thanks to both of you for coming into our studio.
Thank you. We really appreciate this. This means a lot for us to have this kind of awareness.
Sure.
Thank you.
Kara Short is the executive director of Access Surf, a local nonprofit that provides free programs for people with disabilities to have access to the beach and ocean. Bill Martin is the owner of Island X Hawaii Old Sugar Mill, and you can learn more about their effort to have permanent beach access mats installed at Ehukai and Ali'i Beach Parks on the Conversations Facebook page.
For years, the cartoon voice of Barbie came from an actress of Polynesian, Native American, and Cuban descent. Hollywood did not know how to cast her on screen, but as a voiceover?
I could be a pony, I could be a princess, I could be a dragon, I could be, you know, somebody who wasn't me.
She's finally been cast as a Pacific Islander, but the journey was not simple. She's on the world.
This afternoon at 1.
This is The Conversation on statewide member support at Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, celebrating our right to protest while staying aware of its limits. But first, your quiz. In today's quiz, we're going out of this world to a place beyond the stars and far, far away. But not too far. We're looking at a dwarf planet located just beyond Neptune's orbit. Professor Mike Brown from the California Institute of Technology's Palomar Observatory discovered it in 2004. This dwarf planet has a triaxial ellipsoid, meaning its major axis is twice as long as its minor axis. In other words, the planet is shaped like an egg. The dwarf planet's elongated shape, together with its rapid rotation of just 4 hours, are thought to be the consequences of a giant collision during its making. This dwarf planet was temporarily named Santa for its discovery on December 28, 2004, just after Christmas. But the original name, which is the name for the Hawaiian goddess of fertility and childbirth, was given to the dwarf planet in 2005. If you know that Hawaiian name of this planet, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Christine Altwies from Hawaii International Child. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
What are the limits of free speech? They may be closer than you think. In recent weeks, a Virginia woman lost her government contracting job for making a well-known gesture at a presidential motorcade, and a Texas woman was threatened with criminal prosecution for an anti-Trump bumper sticker. These are two very different cases, and there are a number of variables involved. But is there a trend here? Mateo Caballero is the legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Hawaii, and he's with us in our studio. Hi, Mateo. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
All right. Free speech issues and the ACLU have long been identified, and I just was reminded that it's the 40th anniversary of the celebrated march in Skokie, at which the ACLU basically reminded us that free speech is free speech whether you want to hear it or not, right?
Yes. The ACLU, started almost 100 years ago, and we have been one of the principal advocates of free speech in the United States. And a lot of the law has developed through cases that the ACLU litigated, including Skokie. And thanks to that, at this point in time, the protections under the First Amendment are very well established and are very robust.
Just for a quick review of the Skokie case, this was a Nazi march in a heavily Jewish Chicago suburb. And the arguments raised pro and con were, one, the ACLU defended their right to march. Opponents of the march said it was approaching that standard of at which free speech becomes inciting to riot, the proverbial yelling fire in a crowded theater. Does that inaccurately describe those issues?
Yes, that's correct. And we saw it kind of play out recently in Charlottesville, where we also had a protest, that at least initially was about, uniting the right. And there were Nazis, there were, hate groups on one side, mm-hmm. and they were the government of Charlottesville tried to push them outside of the city. And the ACLU of Virginia had to intervene to essentially allow them to protest in the city. Mm-hmm. Of course, unfortunately, there were then violent acts that are not protected by the First Amendment and that the ACLU, of course, condemns. But in terms of their right to march and protest, we saw it just like in Skokie, that is important to set the precedent that no matter what the speech says, you cannot, you know, the government cannot interfere with that speech, with that right to free speech.
And yet, what about the argument that there's a clear link between the words being uttered or words being written on signs and the violence that results?
Well, you know, there is a point at which speech becomes an imminent threat to someone. Incitement to riot. You know, in the case of Skokie and the case of Charlottesville, based on the information that we had at the time, that wasn't the case. We just saw it as, you know, generally calling for, you know, hate speech that is not targeting any specific individual and that is just addresses an entire group. The ACLU's position is that that's not an imminent danger to anyone. And so when it comes down to, and for example, one of the positions that the ACLU has had for a long time, going back to the 1930s, is that if you protest and you couple hate speech with, for example, firearms, then it's a different situation because mm-hmm. then there can be, it can be argued that there is an imminent threat and also that you are chilling other person's speech because there will be counter-protesters, just like there were in Charlottesville. In fact, there were way more counter-protesters than protesters. And so, you know, again, our position is that it's better that there be a marketplace of ideas, that these things be brought out to the open, that no one should feel prosecuted because of their ideas. When ideas cross that mark to an imminent threat to someone, you know, it's a case-by-case type of decision.
Going case-by-case, the Virginia case, the woman was a government contractor.
Yes.
And having it be on social media, her, you know, indicating her disrespect for the chief executive could be seen as a legitimate cause of action to fire her, which is what happened, right?
So the Virginia case, you know, it is as important to understand what is protected by the First Amendment as it is to understand what it isn't.
Yeah.
And so the First Amendment, as I said before, you know, it's really, it gives you far-reaching protections from the government. But it does not give you protections from a private party. And here, the government contractor is a private party. Mm-hmm. And as far as we know, you know, it didn't fire her because there was government pressure, either implicit or explicit, to fire this employee.
They chose.
They chose to do it. And so in that case, the First Amendment doesn't even come into play. Mm-hmm. Essentially, private companies can and do regulate, you know, their employees in a number of ways, including, you know, in the form of social media type policies. And they're generally allowed to enforce those policies. And, you know, it isn't always problematic. For example, going back to Charlottesville, there were a lot of accounts that after the protest in Charlottesville, after people protested as part of that Unite the Right protest, when they went back home, they were fired from their jobs. Mm-hmm. And in part because, you know, customers and coworkers didn't feel safe working with someone that espoused those views.
Mm-hmm. In Texas, a bumper sticker resulted in a threat, it didn't get carried out, of a disorderly conduct charge. That seemed like a stretch.
Well, in that case, it's a lot more direct because you have a government employee, you have a sheriff, that is threatening a person, a private party, for exercising their free speech rights. You know, there is nothing in, and that goes to the my previous point about why it's important to defend the free speech rights of hateful groups like in Skokie and Charlottesville, because you don't want a sheriff, you don't want this administration to be making decisions as to what is good speech or bad speech, what is hateful and what isn't hateful. And like in that Texas case where there were messages aimed at the president, and then a sheriff just decided upon himself that somehow incited violence or that somehow incited disorderly conduct. You know, that's why we have the First Amendment. The sheriff's office shouldn't be making that decision alone. and the First Amendment should protect those forms of speech.
Well, that sheriff operates in a climate where now, if you say something that offends the President of the United States, you might get a personal attack from the President of the United States. I'm wondering what that does to the overall climate of the nation.
So there is no question that the norms around the First Amendment are eroding, and in great part because of this administration, in great part because of the White House's action, during the past 11 months. And one thing was when President Trump, then at the time candidate Trump, kind of responded to any attack and kind of used the bully pulpit against people as candidate. At the time he was a private citizen, but now he's the president of the United States. He has an entire regulatory machinery behind him that he can use to intimidate people, or he can use to grant favors, or go after people. And so it is a lot more troubling, this trend that we're seeing, that the president essentially responds to everything through by threatening people or just insulting people.
Well, Matteo, I get the feeling this is not the last time we're going to be called upon to talk about this. I thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Chris, and I look forward to coming back.
Yeah. Matteo Caballero is the legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Hawaii. He joined the ACLU in 2016 and has been working to defend and advance civil rights and liberties of everyone in Hawaii.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
The Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, a branch of the Department of Human Services, has a laudable mandate, helping people with disabilities find and keep jobs. It can only meet its stated goals if it has the budget, though, and that's the problem. Disability rights advocates and DVR clients say the division is out of money, and the division employees have told them as much. But a Department of Human Services spokesperson dismisses those reports as misinformation. Reporter Suvan Lee sorts out the confusion in today's reality check. Good morning, Suvan.
Good morning, Chris.
Is this as simple as clients being misinformed, as that spokesman said?
Well, I think you really have to take into account what people are saying around the issue. Of course, you have on one hand families who say they've been contacted by DVR reps and counselors saying that their funding will be cut off at some point in the immediate future. Mm-hmm. And you have DHS spokespeople on the other hand saying that's actually misinformation and we apologize for the miscommunication. Your payments will only be delayed and not actually cut off. But it's important to note that sort of the catalyst for all this was an so-called order of selection that was instituted last month. Mm-hmm. That definitively does create a waiting list for potential applicants for disabled job seekers. That much is true. So I think a lot of the swirl of confusion sort of stems from that development last month, which in fact is in place and that is true moving forward.
Well, what was the term you used, order of selection?
It's called an order of selection, and this is completely acceptable under federal law. It's not uncommon for states who provide vocational rehabilitation services to clients to enter into an order of selection. And basically, in plain language, what it is it creates a waiting list for those with disabilities. So those with the most severe disabilities are at the top of the list in terms of getting services for their job-seeking efforts. But what it does is it delays services for those who are not as severely disabled. So what it does is basically winnow the potential pool of clients. And the DHS/DVR had to enter into this order essentially because of the funding questions that are in place. And what's happening exactly when it comes to the budgeting and the management of funds isn't totally clear. But according to DHS, they say that they are looking into it and trying to work through it.
Well, order of selection, it sounds like one of those handy government euphemisms for you're not going to get what you want right now, if ever.
Well, it's part of the federal law. It is under the Federal Rehabilitation Act. It is a mechanism that states can turn to create a waiting list for services. But it's not an ideal situation. As advocates will tell you, it is not preferred. Hawaii actually did this before in 2008, although they came out of it. So it remains to be seen how this is actually going to impact potential clients. And then on the other hand, you have the clients with existing employment plans. So we'll see if their funding does come through continuously.
Well, it's certainly something to keep an eye on, isn't it, Suvan?
We will.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yes, thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Suvan Lee.
Financing the American dream can be tough, tougher if you're an immigrant.
If you're a foreign-born person, you don't have a credit history in this country, you don't have a high income, you have no assets, how are you going to get a loan from a bank?
I'm Kai Rizdahl, local lending, never mind the bank. Next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, right after All Things Considered.
Honolulu is changing rapidly, and as population increases in the urban core, so do the ways people get around a bustling city. Chris Sayers is the bicycle coordinator for the city in the Department of Transportation Services. It's his responsibility to keep abreast of those changes as part of his department's Complete Streets program. We spoke with him to get an update.
It's changing. There's more and more drivers all the time. There's more and more condominiums and housing being built. And so there's just going to be more and more people out on the streets.
Yeah.
And so what we're trying to do is make the streets complete and safe for all users of all ages. When I say all users, we have pedestrians, we have people on bikes, we have transit users, and of course drivers.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to make those all those modes safe for anybody that might choose one of those. We sometimes call them alternative modes. Whether we think of driving as the normal mode,
yeah.
But there's a lot of people that would like to choose bicycling or walking. They might not feel safe for various reasons, and so that might deter them.
So complete streets in the sense of accommodating every mode of transportation and keeping them out of each other's way. That's the issue, right?
As much as possible, right. So, King Street, for instance, the protected bike lane, we try to separate the bicyclists from the pedestrians, separate the bicyclists from the motorists as much as possible. They're still mixing areas at the intersections and driveways.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that example, before we put that in, we had 70% of bicyclists on the sidewalk, and now we're down to like 4%. So we really have separated the modes, and we try to do that as much as possible.
How do you measure something like that?
Well, we actually watched video tape. There's the traffic cameras.
It makes sense.
The one particular one we used was at King and Kalakaua,
uh-huh.
And we watched hours and hours of footage, and it was quite time.
Just did the math. Huh?
We counted, and we actually counted everybody, and now we continue to count. And so the number of bicyclists on King Street has more than doubled, and like I said, most of the people are now in there and off of the sidewalk.
The whole idea of finding out what the public's concerns are informs what you folks do. And have you, been surprised by some of the things you've heard, or do they go pretty much in line with what you might have expected? But you've been assessing the public's concerns.
Right. We're constantly, even before these efforts, we constantly get comments and we learn about the issues. But even more so now, we've been having a lot of public meetings. And yeah, people are concerned about the sidewalks being too narrow, maybe cracks in the sidewalk with tripping hazards, and just the speed of traffic is a concern for pedestrians. So there are certain kinds of built environment projects that we can do. We can have bulb outs at corners, so it's a shorter crossing distance for pedestrians.
A what?
A bulb out. So a bulb out, you might have seen them at King Street and Eisenberg, for instance. What we actually do is make the space that cars are not really using and make it so pedestrians can step out further into the roadway. It makes them more visible. It actually creates space for the pedestrian, and we demarcate it with either In the case of King and Eisenberg, we used curbing and we used planters and some paint in that area that designates it as a pedestrian area as opposed to a regular roadway area.
No chance that a car would mistake it for its territory.
No, we haven't had any problems there. And then the ones that maybe were a little more recently in the news were the ones in Chinatown, which may be a little more controversial there, with just the different uses going on there, and so some of those have been modified slightly. But the idea is to just increase pedestrian safety, shorten the crossings, make pedestrians more visible to drivers, and also to slow drivers down going straight through and especially turning movements.
One of the things that is characteristic of the urban core in any city is that people are in a hurry.
Right.
So it isn't just the volume of drivers; it's their state of mind. They're pretty impatient.
That's correct. And so, it does come down to, you know, we talk about the sort of three E's of safety, and you have the engineering, which is a lot of what we're focusing on with these projects, with what I said, like the bulb outs and the various engineering projects. And then you have education. So we try to educate all the users, again, to be safe out there. And then there's enforcement, and that's really another educational tool, really.
Yeah.
But when you have, you know, enforcement, and that's the other leg that's very important.
Now, how do you go about enforcement? It's you know, things that happen when things go wrong with a pedestrian accident or something, it takes a split second, and nobody might have witnessed it.
That's true. I think, it is up to HPD for the enforcement. We try to do some education, and like I said, the engineering, but they are tasked with the enforcement. And they do enforce both. They do have pedestrian safety programs, the mm-hmm. HPD does, where they do enforcement of driver infractions and pedestrian. And so they do have their own separate efforts out there. And like I say, it's difficult sometimes to catch everybody and change behaviors, but there is an effort to do that.
Is there a lot of video monitoring available for enforcement purposes?
I don't know that they use video monitoring for enforcement. That's a different topic. I think somebody else would have to answer to that.
But the whole idea of changing a culture is really what this Complete Streets efforts is all about, ultimately, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. So sometimes these projects are very visible and it gets people talking, and people have been very supportive in general. We have public meetings where people come out and it's all different types. Sometimes you have the bicycle advocates. We have people who are, more of the pedestrian advocates. And then you have people that are making sure we don't go too far and take away too many lanes or do something that makes driving too onerous. And actually, when we do projects, that's pretty much the first thing we think about. How is this going to affect? We're not trying to mess up the roads and congest the roads any more than they are. It's all about safety.
Well, probably the most visible to most residents of the Honolulu urban core would be what's been done on King Street.
That's right.
Right, with the dedicated bike lane.
It was controversial at first, and we got a lot of complaints, but we've had some public meetings lately where people saying, you know, I didn't like that at first, but I'm really getting used to it. And even some people said, I haven't ridden a bike for years, but now I feel pretty safe going there. And we've also seen with the Beaky, the bike share bikes, that there are, I think a lot of people thought, oh, that's probably for the tourists. But we've seen a lot of local people, and you can just tell, some people with helmets and probably not tourists bringing their own helmet. And we can just tell sometimes that people are using them from commuting quite a bit, and we do see a lot of people on King Street, and like I said, the numbers are up actually more than double. I think we're up to about 1,100 a day now. It was about 400 before we did anything, so the numbers have been very promising.
Have you been able to learn from programs in other cities?
Yeah, absolutely. We're always looking at best practices, and before we did anything on King Street, we looked at what other cities had done, and we learned from quite a few different cities, and we're changing all the time. If you notice, our latest protected bike lane was on South Street that we opened this year, and that we did make some minor changes to the design that added some safety and with just better maintenance-wise, just a little bit better.
Do you have an ongoing kind of feedback loop with the public when people go on your website and, you know, complain or congratulate or do whatever
Absolutely,
they need to do?
Yeah. There's a couple of ways. I mean, people can always go to the city website and go to the transportation department, and there's ways. If you want to go directly to the Complete Streets website, it's honolulu.gov/complete streets, and so that's one way that they can comment.
Ideas to keep learning from the public, right?
Very much so, yes.
Chris Sayers is the bicycle coordinator for the city in the Department of Transportation Services, a position he has held for almost 24 years.
Hi, I'm Tim from the Democratic Party of Hawaii, and you're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Stargazer Time, weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and what we can look for in our dark island skies. Tapping into the expertise of Christopher Phillips, he's on the line. Welcome back, Christopher. What are you going to be telling us about this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for both Venus and Jupiter in the morning sky during dawn in the southeast. The moon this week will be a waxing crescent that will grow as the week goes on.
Now, recently in the news, we've been hearing a whole lot about Russia for some time. And I understand that, believe it or not, entirely different topic relating to them. You've got a story today that has something to do with Russia.
Indeed I do. As evidence mounts in the case that Mars was once a habitable world, perhaps with oceans and a significant atmosphere, there has been some debate as to what happened to any possible Martian life once the planet became hostile. A research group in Moscow has published a study that indicates that Martian microbes may have been able to survive the hostile conditions on the Red Planet, perhaps for even 20 million years.
First question I have is, are we sure this is not fake news of some kind?
I'm pretty sure this is not fake news.
Had to do the Phillips truth test. And so how'd they come to this conclusion? They have some secret supply of Martian microbes that the rest of us don't know about?
They don't. We don't have any Martian microbes here on the Earth, but what we do have are Earth microbes that we can test by creating an artificial Martian environment.
Exactly. How did they do that?
They used microbes that are found in the permafrost in the Arctic here on the Earth and exposed them to intense gamma-ray radiation, extremely low atmospheric pressure and temperature.
Sounds pretty extreme. Was that a fatal result?
Quite the opposite, in fact. A high percentage of the microbes survived, indicating that not only would it be possible for microbes to survive on Mars, but perhaps elsewhere in the solar system where there are similar extreme conditions.
You're saying the threshold for survival of these microbes is a lot lower temps than we really thought.
It is. In fact, these are a type of microbes we refer to as extremophiles due to their resilience. In fact, extremophiles have been known about for many, many years, so we do know that this is credible evidence.
Well, we will count on you to keep a tab on that, and if anything changes with the Russian revelations relating to the Martian microbes, I know you'll pass them along to us, won't you?
Absolutely, Dave.
It's Christopher Phillips and another fascinating report. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, featuring ZipPass, a new online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
Earlier in the show, we asked you about the dwarf planet that resides just beyond Neptune's orbit. The newly discovered dwarf planet received its name under the International Astronomical Union's guidelines for naming planets, which requires that the Kuiper Belt objects be given names of mythological beings associated with creation. The dwarf planet is named after the matron goddess of the island of Hawaii, where the Mauna Kea Observatory is located. The Hawaiian goddess Haumea is the goddess of fertility and childbirth, with many children that sprang from different parts of her body. This corresponds to the swarm of icy bodies thought to have broken off the dwarf planet during its ancient collision. In addition, she often is identified with Papa, the goddess of the Earth, which at the time seemed appropriate because our dwarf planet was thought to be composed almost entirely of solid rock, and Haumea was the answer we were looking for. And Arlene Buklerowitz from Volcano on the Big Island got that right, and there's a reason. She says she's a docent at Emi Loa So she knew the answer right away. Indeed, thanks very much for that, and you're today's winner. And thanks to Kainoa Grusby for inspiring today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for the conversation comes from Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu and Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school. Now accepting applications at both schools.
Hawaii is at the crossroads of many of the world's cultures, and as such, it's a place where a great many people have struggled to find their identity far from home. That struggle is a concern for Kiki, a young playwright whose latest effort continues the story of a young mixed-race Samoan woman and her search, both literal and figurative, for a home. Kiki's with us in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Is this to some degree your story?
This is. I believe that all our stories are come from us.
I wouldn't argue with that at all. But what is the story? Tell me a little bit about it.
So this story, Fa'alavelave, The Interruption, is about Mele, who loses her father that she's never met, and she inherits some land as well as a lot of family secrets that affect her and her relationships.
Land in Hawaii?
In Hawaii, yes.
And she is from Samoa?
No, she's from Hawaii. So I like to write for the people of the diaspora, and especially for my generation, who don't feel the connection to Samoa and don't feel the connection to wherever we are. So in that gray space that we often live in and around.
Not entirely of any one place, sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like?
It was very confusing at first, but I feel like, you know, after years of struggling with identity, I've reached a point where this is my home, and a freedom of speech, really, to speak on behalf of both sides, and I think there's a forgiveness as well that comes with that territory of living in the gray.
Forgiveness of whom?
Forgiveness of self, forgiveness of the past.
Why would you need to forgive yourself?
I think it has to do with identity and struggling with identity and forgiving. I've had to forgive myself for a lot of things.
Don't we all? I mean, that's fairly...
I have to forgive myself for writing these stories.
Uh-huh. In terms of finding your own identity, there's a cultural identity to be found, how you fit within a larger group, and a personal identity, how you relate to yourself. And that's I think, what you say when you talk about forgiveness. We all have to some degree, accept ourselves. And maybe society isn't that accepting. Has that been part of your journey?
Yes, a huge part of my journey.
In what way?
Well, take coming out, for example.
As a gay woman?
Yes, yes. I've struggled with that. And I feel like every time I have a show produced, every time I do an interview, it's just another coming out and another portion of me saying, it's okay. It's okay. Just come out. People are going to react the way they react. And really, I think, you know, nobody really cares.
It seemed like a bigger thing than it was when you did it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's easy for people to feel marginalized by choices they make in their lives, by who they are, and by who they are in terms of their cultural identity as well. So what you've got is an identity in terms of your personal choices that might have you marginalized, as well as being from a different culture, a distant culture that tends, and we in America tend to marginalize people from what we see as the fringes. So that could push you to the, you know, that could push you away from a feeling of acceptance, couldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there, I remember growing up feeling very lonely in that. And what I found in having my writing produced is that there are so many people in that same boat. Mm-hmm. And so we're not as lonely as we think.
That's a positive message, isn't it?
Mm.
It also indicates that your writing has been therapeutic for you.
It has been.
What kind of things do people who have seen, and you've done another play based on this same character, what kind of things do people tell you about that play?
The greatest compliment that's bigger than any award is when people say thank you. Thank you for writing this. Please keep writing. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect seeing this story on stage, more my story on stage. Mm-hmm. And so thank you for that. I had one woman thank me and then write me on Facebook about how she never understood her girlfriend's situation when it came to religion, but the play brought her more perspective.
You know, it seems so ironic to me, Kiki, because so many plays have been written about so many aspects of the human experience. You would think we would have gotten to most of them by now, right?
Right?
Seem that way to you, too?
Yes.
Well, you found something that others hadn't approached, so.
Yeah, which is very odd, I think.
It is odd. I mean, you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah. In the grand scheme of time, someone must have addressed these issues. But, okay, I'll be that person.
Well, it's great that you have. It's just I share your surprise that it hadn't been some. But, you know, all the more reason to do it.
Right.
How does the story, tell me a little bit about your character, the character in your play, and what happens in this play?
A lot of things happen to her. So the death of her father, mm-hmm. and her fiancé, who's making all these decisions that affect her life. And I think she's that character who doesn't have a lot of say until the very end. And so it's interesting in navigating her experience.
How she sort of takes more control of her life. Yeah.
Right, right.
Well, it sounds like a pretty worthy project, Kiki.
Oh, thank you.
It also sounds as if you have more plays in you along those lines.
I do.
Good.
I have a whole family history that inspires them.
Well, you could do a whole 10-play cycle, you know, like August Wilson, right?
Right.
There you go. Hey, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you so much,
really
Chris.
Really good to talk to you. University of Hawaii Master of Fine Arts Playwriting candidate Kiki, a.k.a. Kiana Rivera, is the author of Fa'ala Lave Lave, The Interruption, which will be performed November 29th through December 3rd at the Earl Ernst Lab Theater on the UH Manoa campus. Well, there's always plenty going on around the state, and our Morning Edition host, Derek Malama, keeps track of them in order to give us a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, we've got a Facebook Live event with Congresswoman Hanabusa.
Yeah, that's happening tomorrow. She'll discuss climate change. The discussion will focus on the current impacts of climate change and possible legislative and non-legislative solutions. And it's from 1 to 3 p.m. on Facebook Live at facebook.com/REP Colleen Hanabusa. You can find a link on our website, and Wayne Yoshioka will report on this topic tomorrow afternoon.
All right, we'll look forward to that.
Yes.
And we're going to learn about, this is unfamiliar to me, Derek,
Grandma
Gatewood's walk?
Yes, so back in 1955, uh-huh. Emma Gatewood told her family she was going for a short walk, and she just left her Ohio town for a long time. And the next thing you know, she had walked 800 miles along the Appalachian Trail.
That's
or
a
Appalachian
walk.
Trail, whatever you want to say. The Travel Book Club will discuss this book by Ben Montgomery. This is on the Big Island tomorrow, and how Grandma Gatewood became a hiking celebrity and why she did this.
Yeah.
The club meets tomorrow at 6:30 in the Kona Stories bookstore in the K.L. Ho Shopping Center. So bring a poo-poo or beverage to share.
And be ready to walk.
Yeah, ready to walk, yes, or hike or all that.
And the Honolulu Biennial is going to the Valley Isle tomorrow.
Yes, and it's part of a series called Island Hopping. Enjoy a night of video art screening, plus a talk by Biennial curator Scott Lorimore. And the video art features works by artists from Palestine, Guam, the Marshall Islands, and Tonga. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. in the McCoy Studio Theater. And this event is free and open to the public, but please RSVP at the email address on our website.
Fair enough, Derek. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. And you can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll talk with the Drug Policy Forum's Carl Berquist about the limited authority allotted to the DEA, allowing it to take action against the sale of opioids, and a new bill that's being proposed that will restore the DEA's ability to tackle that crisis. We want to hear what's on your mind, and you can call our talkback line with feedback on any topics you'd like us to cover. That number is 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or reach us through Twitter at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.